It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It was 50 years ago this month when a police raid on a local New York bar sparked the Stonewall Rebellion, began the modern gay rights movement. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It was a small, unobtrusive bar that catered to the LGBTQ community when, on June 28th, officers from the now-defunct Public Morals Squad descended on the establishment. It was around midnight. Authorities said it was carrying out the raid because Stonewall Inn had violated liquor laws. Police ordered some 200 patrons to line up, insulting them and slamming them against the wall, all the while demanding IDs and, of some, anatomical inspections. Such raids were not uncommon in the day, but this time they fought back because they had had enough. Well, 50 years later, New York's police commissioner, James O'Neill, issued an apology for the raid on behalf of the department. To take a look at Stonewall's legacy and how far we've come in our studio this morning, we have Mark Delancey. He is president of Salisbury's PFLAG chapter, which stands for Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. Also, Michelle Schlehofer, associate professor of psychology department at Salisbury University, also associated with PFLAG as well as with the Safe Spaces program. And Murray Archibald, executive director and co-founder of Camp Rehoboth, a local organization that tends to the needs of the LGBTQ community. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I want to start with you, Murray. As you look back, and I was actually reading about what happened. I mean, Stonewall was not exactly the upper crust of bars. Apparently, it was owned by the mob at one point. Take me back. Can you imagine what that period was like before we finally had to sort of blossom him out into the 1970s?
It is hard to think back to those days because even the terms we use right now are not. You know, you said LGBTQ, but, you know, nobody had any idea of anything like that. It was just, you know, there were much worse words being used every time you turn around. I was 15 at the time, and I think I was part of a generation that suddenly realized, you know, this is not right. We are who we are, and, you know, we were discovering ourselves, and I think that was happening in New York. You know, all the club scene there was sort of people. Those bars were very important to people. They were their lifelines. They had, you know, they didn't have gay and lesbian organizations. They didn't have bookstores. They had to have a place where they could go and to find one another and to, you know, to say, here we are. We're not the people that society's saying we are. You know, we're not the names they're calling us. You know, the funny thing for me was that at that age, as I was beginning to come out, you know, I had all these books that described what homosexual meant. I never put that together, that was me. I had been, you know, chasing boys for my entire life. But all of a sudden, one day, I went, oh, that's what they're talking about, you know? But that's not me. It didn't make any sense to me. And I think it didn't make any sense to a generation then who suddenly discovered who they were. Now,
at the time,
their voice.
Well, at the time, as a matter of fact, the organizations that did exist were much more into assimilation and trying to create images as opposed to the kind of protest that obviously broke out with Stonewall. Although we should add that there were some incidents in Los Angeles, I think in San Francisco as well, prior to Stonewall,
yes,
where you did have some, but it didn't really seem to take off in terms of we've had enough.
Yeah, there had been some. I mean, some of the other organizations had been organized, and they were trying to make themselves visible, and they were trying to show we're part of you. I think the thing about Stonewall that strikes us is that it was that explosion. It was that moment when the fire struck, and everybody just said, you know, no. And it was the drag queens, and you know they were out there. Everybody in the club, you know, the New York's community is, gay community is quite varied and, you know, can be extreme. You know, it was all kinds of people, but they just said, we're not going to take it anymore.
Was it part of this is just simply the explosive nature of the decade itself? I mean, we really saw sort of this cultural explosion.
I said that earlier, living through it, it just seemed natural, you know? I mean, everything was sort of rebellion, you know? We were standing up everywhere. I was on the younger end of the hippie spectrum, but that's where I was, you know. And I mean, I was very much with that. My friends were older. The whole gay thing was, you know, it was this whole open new thing, and it was our way of standing up and saying, you know, things are changing. We certainly didn't get everything right, but as a generation, but you know, we did. It was happening all over. So,
as you move into the 70s, did you feel like there was, and I've read this before, that there was sort of this beginning to have this open space prior to the 1980s, and particularly AIDS, but there was this open, that suddenly there was a certain liberating quality going on in that decade?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was amazing. And it was, people felt free. I mean, you look at what was happening in San Francisco and in New York, and I mean, even I was in Alabama, you know, so.
Right.
I was born in Rainbow City, Alabama, which seems very appropriate to me. But anyway, my dad was a Methodist minister in the North Alabama Conference. He was very liberal for that area, and I never felt anything but love for my family. You know, it was a time of change, and it was
It was. When you came out, I mean, how did you come out during that period? And did you come out to your parents? And if so, how did that work? And then, I mean, as you then move out to friends and elsewhere, and particularly at that moment in time?
You know, I think part of it was my own sort of rebellion that was part of that age. But also as a preacher's kid, you know, I was the oldest of my brothers and sisters. And so I came out. Once I realized it, I was not used to keeping a secret. So, you know, I told my parents right away. And, you know, they pretty much said, we figured that out. I was a theater major in school, and I was, you know, so I embraced it as quickly as I could. It wasn't, I don't think I had to go through the kind of agonizing that some people did. And part of that was the times. It was this, you know, this liberating time when you could stand up and say things like that. And,
And your friends and colleagues, I mean, they also, I mean, how did they react? Did you get any mixed reactions?
Most of the friends that I had were very, you know, they were artists and they were theaters and people. And we were, you know, it was this real sort of, even though we were in Alabama, it was this very sort of avant-garde group of people who were embracing everything. And so, yeah, it wasn't that hard for me, but that is not the case for many people, and it's still not the case today. They're, you know, coming out can be a difficult thing for people.
I want to turn to Mark here, because one of the most significant, I think, organizations to come out of this movement has been PFLAG. I mean, if you get PFLAG involved with a particular issue, you always tend to warn the other side, wait till you see what happens, because this is an organization that really has organizing power, really a lot of support. Tell me a little bit about its origin and your involvement.
I'll start with my involvement of PFLAG. Actually, I started here. This is the first PFLAG chapter that I actually started with. I would probably not want to join PFLAG. And the whole reason being was because I personally wasn't ready to do that. And in doing that, I decided that because of my story of coming out and everything, everybody has their unique story. In doing so, and in that process, I really didn't want to put that label on me. Being labeled homosexual was already a stigma enough, and to also join a national chapter of PFLAG and to be part of that was putting myself front and center. But after, you know, a lot of soul searching and consideration, I decided to go ahead and join the local chapter here along with Michelle, to help that organization and bring a unique perspective to that I bring with prior military, coming out in the 70s, a whole AIDS perspective that a lot of people and youth nowadays don't know about that. Mm-hmm. This PFLAG chapter definitely has a lot to offer. Having the national part and the support of the national chapter and how that starts is a great thing to have, but also gives us the individuality to be able to perform and do what we need to do individually because of the demographics that we have. So we're able to reach out to the certain demographics that we need and be able to reach them personally with the support of a mother organization.
And tell me, does your experience coming out, how does that compare to what we just heard?
Well, I was five. So when the riot started. So
not much cognizance. Yeah. I understand that one.
So I really didn't know that much. But I, again, with what Murray was saying, that you there was nothing. Absolutely nothing. There were no TV shows. There were no role models. There were no. There was nothing. So when you were able to get to a bar or a cruising spot or whatever you want to call them, to find someone that you were able to connect with on an individual basis, you clung onto them no matter whether you were family. And that was the term that we used. We were family. And it was hard, and you just learned to appreciate anyone and everyone. And I had what they called then was a mother hen to help me come out and to help me realize who you are and what's going on. But then again, I didn't tell my family until way down the road, because even though I knew who I was coming out at 15, 1970-something-ish, I didn't come out to anybody. I didn't say anything. And then I joined the military. So, and that was during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So I couldn't say anything. But of course, there was a gay bar right outside the base. You could see it from post. Everybody met. There were several. And you went out and had a good time. And you just kept that second half of your life secret. And it didn't stop you from performing your duties. It didn't stop you from who you were as an individual. As a matter of fact, it enhanced me for being both. And it was something that was able to ground me, but yet also push me in the direction that I needed to realize of activism and not being ashamed of who I am.
How aware were your fellow soldiers of your status,
you,
I guess?
You pick and choose. You pick and choose, basically, on who you can trust. You trust everyone that you're stationed with your life. You trust everyone that you're in your foxhole with your life, but you don't trust them with your identity. And it's kind of a different way to put it. So being gay is a different identity for some people. So in that classification, while you trust somebody next to you in a foxhole with your life, you may not be able to trust them knowing who you are as an individual. But the gay community was the other side of the coin. You could trust them with who you are. And you could trust them to be there for you, and you could trust them to do things for you, but you wouldn't necessarily trust them to give them your life, because they had to hide themselves as individuals as well.
Hmm. Michelle, I want to turn to you. So tell me a little bit about your involvement with PFLAG and what you know of its history.
Oh, sure. So, well, I can actually speak to the history. So PFLAG actually started in the early 1970s with a mother that decided she wanted to publicly support her gay son. And I believe that was in 1971. So she marched in a pride parade with her gay son and then formed the first PFLAG chapter in New York City. And at the time, that was a really radical act, right? So it's not that parents weren't necessarily supportive. And I think we heard from Murray that there definitely were parents that were supportive of their kids. But just as kids were closeted, parents were closeted too, right? And faced stigma, and faced admonishment and degradation for having raised children who are LGBTQ. So the fact that parents were willing to publicly come out as being parents of LGBTQ youth and express that as a source of pride, that was really very radical and revolutionary. So that's where PFLAG's roots come from. And since that time, obviously, as the awareness of LGBTQ people and the diversity that LGBTQ people bring in their community has grown, so has chapters have grown. So I actually am not from this area. And when I moved here, I was really quite surprised at the lack of resources for the LGBTQ community. So I did my graduate training in Southern California, and I had done projects with the local LGBTQ center in West Hollywood, and I was really familiar with working with LGBTQ communities, and there was nothing here. The closest was Camp Rehoboth, which is close, but it's still pretty remote and hard to get to for some people in this area. So just seeing the need, seeing the lack of resources, It took me a few years to come to terms with the fact that something had to be done, and I had the skills to do it. So so I did two things. So I started the PFLAG chapter, and I also became involved in the Safe Spaces program through Salisbury University. So Safe Spaces is a program that we work across the state of Maryland in partnership with the Maryland Commission on Civil Rights to train people both in university settings and outside. So a lot of state agencies, people on how to make their organizations inclusive of LGBTQ people. And that inclusivity is important. So I do want to touch on the don't ask, don't tell that Mark mentioned, if you don't mind. So,
sure, go ahead.
I think don't ask, don't tell. One of the things that there was concern about when that was being repealed was how would this affect unit cohesion? How would this affect the military? And the research that's emerged since that time has actually found that don't ask, don't tell was a terrible policy for the very reason that Mark mentioned. So if you can't trust people with your identity, then obviously, you know, you can trust them with your life, but you're not really fully trusting somebody. So the research since that time has found that don't ask, don't tell, the repeal of it has actually been really good for increasing military cohesion and unit readiness. So, you know, the inclusivity is important. Making sure that we have supportive spaces in our environments, various environments, is important. And that's why I got involved in the work.
Murray, I see you making some notes there. What are some of your thoughts there?
You said something earlier about families. You were talking about coming out. And I've observed over the years that, you know, families have to come out, too, eventually. If you have a gay, transgender child, whatever, the whole family changes. The whole family has to go through an experience. And I'll take it even further that Steve and I worked, you know, for years within Epworth United Methodist Church, and, you know, to make it for many years the only reconciling United Methodist Church, which means that they welcomes gays and lesbians fully into the church in Delaware. So the church had to go through the same thing. You know, the church had to go through this period where they wrestled with the issue, where they started to say, we welcome gays. And then they got shunned by other churches, and they got, you know, they're doing great now. You know, and they're standing as a, you know, the church stands as in strong support. And it's a different issue here. We're talking about the Methodists, but, you know, there are issues going on in all the churches where this issue is still wounding people. You know, it's still hurting people. And it's, and I mean, you start looking at figures about, you know, runaways and homeless, LGBTQ youth who have been still thrown out of their houses because the family believes so strongly. It's not just an individual, you know, and you're so right about that, that it's the family and the community around it. And I think that's sort of where, you know, we began with Camp Rehoboth was that camps, the CAMP stands for Create a More Positive, so it was Create a More Positive Rehoboth. It's where, and also Rehoboth was founded as a Methodist campground. But you see all these parts and stories keep coming back together in my life. But we wanted to create safe and positive space for people. Now, it started in Rehoboth because Rehoboth is a beach resort, and it pulls from, you know, Baltimore, Washington, Philadelphia, New York, you know, all the mid-Atlantic cities. So we had a great base to build on. It wasn't, we weren't just starting. I think we have a pretty big community center for a town the size of Rehoboth, that's for sure. But it was creating that, the feeling that we're all equal, you know, and that we're all sharing in this experience. Not that we're any better or anything, not that, you know, but, and I've seen that happen as neighbors get to know people who are gay, as people in your community get to know you, as they begin to see you, that you're just a human, you know, we're just human beings all, you know, living who we are and working together. So that was the base for Camp Rehoboth.
Let me ask you this. The 1980s comes along, and so does AIDS. And the Reagan administration, to say the least, basically ignored this. and I'm not sure even mentioned it for a long, long time. Or what was that period like? Because as I moment ago, 1970 seemed to be this moment of liberation, and yet here comes this disease, which is like taking friends. They just disappear, you know?
It was life-changing. It's hard for me to describe those, what that was like to my nieces and nephews right now, because they just almost can't conceive of what I'm talking about. And I have a number of gay nieces and nephews, but it was this huge liberating thing. And then suddenly it came to a screeching halt, you know, and all of a sudden, everybody was free for the first time and then experimenting and, you know, just finding themselves. And then they started dying. Our friends started dying. And I was in, Steve and I, we were in New York in the early, very early 80s, I mean, in Washington. We moved to New York a few years after that. So, you know, as we started to head into the peak of AIDS, we were at ground zero there. And we lost so many friends. I don't think Camp Rehoboth would exist without what we learned from fighting AIDS, from standing up and saying, you've got to listen, you know, you don't ignore this anymore. It was like going through a war, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that you came out of it shell-shocked. We moved here to Rehoboth in full-time in 90. We'd been going there in summers for a long time. And by that time, it was hitting so hard, outside the bigger cities, that we were losing friends up until 94, when they really began to develop treatments that would slow down the dying. There was a month in Rehoboth where we buried somebody every weekend, you know, all month long. Mm. It was happening that fast, and then it changed pretty quickly after that. But it was a pivotal moment in my life. I would not be who I am without living through that. And there's something that happens to you when you're with people who are dying. It's painful, it's difficult, but it's a gift too. And the things that we learned and the experience we had from that was, well, I wouldn't be the same. I don't think Camp Rehoboth would be the same. We wouldn't have done what we've done.
One of the things that struck me, I was actually in Washington during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell hearings. I watched them. And one of the things that really struck me about that, which is like we're talking about like 93, 94 or something like that, is that we saw, I remember particularly on the dais, four former service people, gay and lesbian, and they were talking, right, testifying before this basic, I think it was all male, I think, time committee. Strom Thurmond, I think, was might have been vice chair, ranking committee. And what struck me is that no matter what was going on, all these senators had to respect and express their appreciation for the service that these four people had done. And I felt like at the time I was seeing some ice beginning to crack. That is to say that, yes, they were going to do the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, there's a sort of halfway measure and so on and so forth, but that things were beginning to change. Are you surprised at how rapid the change has been? I mean, rapid, I say 20 years, right? But in public attitudes from that period of time in which you had Congress pass this law, and then, you know, some 10, 15 years later, they repeal it. It's done with. I'll start with you, Marie, and then.
Having been in the midst of it, yeah, there did come a point where I thought, wow, this is moving faster than I would have thought. You know, and gay marriage, especially when it got here, was thrilling. And I could talk for quite a while about that and the difference it made to me to be able to say, this is my husband when he was dying in the hospital, and the way that changes the world around you. But yes, I was surprised, and I wasn't, because I'd been in the middle of it. I knew what the fight was. But you do see attitudes changing. And I think that in the same way that it was when I was 15, that, 15-year-olds and 20-year-olds now have a are seeing the world in a better way. And I'm hopeful that we'll just keep going in this direction. I don't think that that some of the things happening in our government right now it seems to be opposite of what people might want there. But I, you know, every progress sort of comes with its back steps.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
Mark, what about you? As you watch this, are you surprised? I was looking at something like there's one poll: 69% of Americans favor protecting non-discrimination for LGBTQ community. That includes jobs, public accommodations, that kind of thing. We also obviously saw the major shift for support for same-sex marriage: 62%. That's a reverse of what it was in 2007. Attitudes have changed along with the laws. Are you surprised at that? And why do you think that happened?
I think a lot of it comes through education and awareness and the brave people that decided to speak up and stand up. So in that education and in that awareness of people just being able to walk the streets and being able to show that we are normal people. We are mothers. We are fathers. We are bankers. We are store owners. And we will continue to do so. And I think one thing that makes us even more unique, even though the education in that aspect is growing in awareness and things that are the acceptance of us and the tolerance of the shift that's been going on, it's moving in a positive way for the most part. It takes a long time for cultures to swing in a way that actually the bell curve to make it's not a bell curve is not a straight line.
Right.
So in that reaction of you will take steps forward as well as taking several back. But in that process, we just have to realize that we need to stay strong. We need to stay aware. We need to stay vigilant in what we do and realize that there are a whole lot of people that got us here to where we are today. And it's beneficial to realize that and remember that. And if I have one thing I'd like to be able to say is that I would really love to see the younger generation realize our history. Mm-hmm. We have a very diverse, beautiful culture. And for people nowadays, the younger generation loves to have social media. So they're very, very app-oriented and very, very quick to satisfy and very quick to judge, and that's not the case where it should be. And as a society, that it's nice to see that the humanity is coming around to that aspect, that we can actually make a contribution on who we are. And to add to that aspect, I would love to see more leadership in the aspect of younger, along with more LGBTQ people stepping up in leadership roles and not necessarily political or government or business, but personally, stepping up to help others, to take on that fulfillment role, to teach, to address issues, and to let people know that we have a beautiful history.
Well, Maury, because you deal with a lot of folks who come to help, do you find that gap in the younger generation? In terms of leadership,
for us in with an organization like ours, we have programs that reach out to kids in the schools. We work with PFLAG and up in Delaware, and we try to deal with issues in schools. But yeah, I think that getting really younger people involved in an organization like Camp Rehoboth. And we do have specialty support groups. We have some, we have a number of groups that, that do meet. But we see most of our like volunteers and our supporters and all, as they get to the end of their 30s, they really start to have an interest in what's going on in the world. They sort of come out of themselves a little bit and they begin to say, oh, I want to get involved. And we start to see that. I think there's a natural part of growing up where you just have to kind of go out and go wild for a while and do whatever you do. And, it's that rebellion. It was for me. But, eventually you find your way. You start to find your center and you start to see where you go. I just hope that I think where we need the most work is where making sure we're not letting kids fall through the cracks, because they're not in a safe home. They're not in a place where they feel like they can come out. And I think the closet is destructive. I think that when you have to hide who you are, you start to not love yourself somewhere inside, and that takes healing at a point in your life. You know, you really can't love other people until you can love who you are. You know, and that sort of sets us free to do that. And so, I don't think the closet is a good thing, and I hope people find it easier to get out than to come out of the closet than they used to. But.
Well, we've been speaking with Mark Delancey. He's president of the Salisbury PFLAG chapter that stands for Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. Also, this is Michelle Schlieghofer. She's associate professor with the psychology department at Salisbury University, also with the Safe Spaces program, as well as associated with PFLAG. And Murray Archibald, the executive director and co-founder of Camp Rehoboth, a local organization that attends the LGBTQ community. I appreciate you all stopping by and chatting with us on this, the 50th anniversary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't think that the mob ever thought that that the bar would become a National Historic site, but nonetheless, there you have it. This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Another baseball field is coming to Wacomico County. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It's called Field 7.5, and we locate it at the Henry S. Parker Athletic Complex in Salisbury. Field would provide a place for the Little League Challenger Division that allows those with physical and intellectual challenges to play the nation's pastime. It's just part of the Tri-County effort to serve nearly 3,000 youth in special education programs. In our studio this morning, to take a look at the new project, Steve Miller, Director of Wacomico County Recreation, Parks, and Tourism. Also, Darren Kovac, he is leader of the Challenger Program at the West Salisbury Little League, and Jeff Johnson, who represents the District 8 Little League. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Steve, let me turn to you, and first of all, tell me a little bit about how this project came about.
So it started probably about 9 months ago. Myself and Chris Bitters, who's the general manager of the Delmarva Shorebirds, we were sitting and talking. We work on a lot of projects together and brainstorming, and Chris actually floated the idea. We were talking about some different projects at the complex, and Chris said, hey, have you ever considered Challenger? And at that point, I wasn't very familiar with the program, so kind of lit a fire when he suggested that. So started to do research and started to understand the population and the number of kids that are out there, and learned how little is being offered. And it just kind of snowballed from there. And the more we talked to people and we reached out and engaged folks, the more we felt like this was a project that really made sense for us as a county and also for the entire region.
So how do you envision this field? Where is it going to be? What kind of amenities are there going to be?
Sure. So as you mentioned, it'll be at the Henry Parker Complex. And the reason we call it Field 7.5 is because we're going to locate it between Field 7 and 8 at the complex. We just recently did a build out this past year to add 4 diamonds out there. So we've got 8 total diamonds. Now this would be the 9th. But so it'd be at the complex, and the idea would be it's a mini ball field. We only have space for a smaller field, but I think it could accommodate this type of activity. And the goal would really be not only to build a field that would be both safe and functional for this activity, but also to add the amenities, like you said. So we want to provide access, obviously. We want to provide parking. We've heard in talking to parents and different folks that shade is very important to Challenger athletes. And then we even want to look at inclusive playground equipment where we could accommodate families while they're there if they're not playing or watching or have siblings, where there's some really neat new playground type equipment where kids with disabilities can interact with other kids on the same equipment. And there's a lot of new stuff out there where we think it'd be neat to incorporate that in as well. So families could really find a home out there and really feel included in the activity that happens.
So in terms of the organizations that you've been involved pulling in, obviously mm-hmm. you've been talking to the folks here, but to others, what kind of support have you gotten, especially from the county executive, Bob Culver?
Yeah, the executive's been 100% on board. He's been extremely supportive. His office has been completely behind the effort. We've talked certainly with the Little Leagues, that was a big part of this, and trying to determine the interest. Jeff could tell you about it, but in District 8, there's 10 Little Leagues. And we went to a meeting, and all 10 Little Leagues were very supportive of the concept. we've talked to the boards of education, special education programs in Wicomico, Worcester, Somerset. They've been supportive. We've talked to Dove Point, Special Olympics. We've tried to reach out to as many groups as we can, and every group that we have talked to, it's been a green light. It's been a very positive response, which has encouraged us to keep pushing this forward.
And what kind of funding are we talking about in terms of doing the field?
So to initially build the field and the required amenities to get you access and those types of things, we anticipate it being about a $500,000 project. So we're seeking partial funding from the county in this budget that's happening right now for next year. State grant and then private donations, we think we can get to that $500,000 goal. If we can exceed that, which my goal is that we will be able to exceed that through private donations, we can look to add extra things. So there's things like field lights or additional playground equipment. There's other amenities that I think you could make it even better for folks. So I think at a minimum, we're looking at around $500,000, and that would be one of the drivers of the cost would be we would want the entire field to be synthetic turf. So there's a safety component to that where you could stitch the bases into the carpet. So if you have someone in a wheelchair or a walker, they're not having to navigate over an obstacle. But we also feel like it would be a safer alternative and really make it a special place to play instead of these kids being thrown to some backfield and kind of being an afterthought. We want to make something special for them so that this can be their home field. They come. They feel special, feel part of things, and so that's what we're looking at in terms of funding.
Darren, I'm going to turn to you. You're with the Challenger program of West Salisbury Little League. First of all, how did you become involved, or how did this come to your attention, and what was your involvement with this?
Actually, my daughter has Downs. She's 27 years old now. My wife went out 23 years ago and seen this started, and picked up on a team out of Del Mar. Basically, this is a team that we moved from Del Mar to West Salisbury about 19 years ago. I was a coach at West Salisbury and had the support of the presidents since 19 years ago all the way through now with the Challengers program there.
So what does this mean to you in terms of seeing this expansion for folks who are challenged like that?
It's great because there's a lot of parents out here that doesn't realize that their child can actually play ball. You have regular kids that grow up that are able to play ball. Then this one family might have one child out of the bunch that cannot play ball, and they don't feel that it's safe for them to play. But if they ever come out to a game, you'll see the smiles and on the kids' faces and stuff. Put it this way, if they don't want to play no innings, if they just want to bat one time, we've had kids dig in the ground and dig for worms and stuff out in the outfield and stuff like that. So there's no...
They do that in regular Little League.
No limit to that.
Yeah.
Actually, no limit to that. Just watching the kids smile. I mean, we've had kids with feeding tubes and stuff in wheelchairs. You have a buddy system. A buddy comes up, swings the bat for them, and just to see that smile on a kid's face, that's nothing else better than that.
So what was you mentioned that you have a daughter that has Downs. So what was that experience like, having someone like that? And I assume she participated in baseball.
She's been participating for a long time. We usually go to Virginia Beach Mother's Day weekend. We've been doing that for several years. They have a big tournament down there. And just watching those kids, other kids from other teams, and you meet other parents with different issues that you've probably already gone through, but they haven't gone through yet. You can help them get through that part of the issue on where they need to go with their child or whatnot and continue playing ball.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard? Was it in terms of raising your kid and your child and trying to adapt to a world which
tends not to be very friendly, I guess.
It's you just got to have the support. You got to have the support around, and some parents don't have that complete support. So when they come to you as a parent with a ball player, then it opens up. It opens their eyes a little bit more. Hey, my child can play. I can relieve a little bit of pressure off myself to have this child out here playing something, not being home the whole time.
So and the kids, they seem to not just simply get along, but there's a certain camaraderie, I think, that takes place at these kinds of games and these kinds of events?
Yes. These games, what we do, the Challengers Division, we play two innings. Everybody bats. The last hitter cleans the bases. He's the cleanup hitter. And then you go into the field, toss the ball. The other team comes up. They'll hit the ball. And there's some other ball players that don't get that ball. So you have a couple extra balls in the field. You toss in the ball. So they're actually being active in the field of play. Then the next inning comes up. You reverse your lineup. The last batter, he's the first hitter. You switch that around. You don't make the last batter always your cleanup hitter. You just change the lineup around.
By the way, now, if you've been involved with, I guess, in Little League for a while then, I mean, beyond this, right?
Oh, yes.
Did you play baseball when you were younger, I guess?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, what's your history with that?
I've played baseball my whole life.
Is that right?
I played softball and everything like that. I was a coach at West Salisbury for years. And when we moved the Challenger team there, I was doing baseball through Little League and Junior League, and my wife was doing the Challengers at the same time, so we were double teaming that.
So I suspect that eventually, and when you get to your 60s and 70s, we're going to see you out there, the seniors, is that right? I talked to a bunch of those guys, and one of them said, well, you know, Father Time is undefeated, but, you know, they get out there anyway.
I can still teach, but I'm not going to play. I'm done playing.
Jeff Johnson, you represent the District 8 Little League. Tell me about how you got involved and how you envision this.
Well, with West Salisbury, I believe my first introduction to it was when we took one of the local teams was in Bristol, Connecticut, advancing. And there was a Challenger game that was played up there. And it was very, very heartwarming to watch the kids, get out there, you know, with whether it be walkers or wheelchairs or whatever it was. And they, you know, they've seen baseball on TV. And so, they would get out there and they knew what we're supposed to do and it'd be done. And when I came back to with West Salisbury, it was sometime in the, about, I guess, 15 years ago, met Darren and Tina, who were running the Challenger program. And it was somewhere by that time they had been at Del Mar, and I think we talked about maybe we'll come over to West Salisbury and see what we can do. And that's kind of how we got started. And really, it's when it comes down to it, it's just kids wanting to play baseball, what we found also is they would be part of, you know, Challenger team is just like any other team we would have out there, participate opening day and all the other events, one thing Darren mentioned earlier about the buddy system. We had kids on other teams that would come out and help participate in the Challenger game. And as you said, basically buddy up with another player and basically just be a one-on-one teammate if they needed help running or hitting or just standing and walking beside them. You know, that's what they did. And I know my son was involved, really took that up. And mm-hmm. even to this day, you probably don't even know this, Darren, but one of the friendships he established uh-huh. with one of the players, you know, they're even though it's 10 plus 12 years now, and they still talk, and they attend birthday parties together, and so it's been a lasting friendship.
Do you think, by the way, that experience like opens that world up and that diversity for regular kids?
Well, I think yes, because I think at that age, and I tell you frankly, even for some adults,
it does.
Don't necessarily how you know it's they see a kid that's you know it's different. But it's all kids. And so I think that was an introduction, you know, it's to, I don't know if you want to say break the ice, but it just provided that opportunity to get to know that that's something that they're not familiar with that and to be a part of.
You agree that there's an interaction?
Yes. It is. It's an eye opener because, you know, we all grow up. Put it this way, and I'll be honest with you: there's probably 90% of people in the world that didn't want to associate with people like that, the kids. Do you have one yourself? That's a bigger eye opener than anything. Than when that sibling has, when your regular child has a sibling in there. You can see that it's more of a connection in the family-wise. Then when it starts spreading out, those kids are protected even more. My daughter, she has Downs. She went to Wye High. She played Wye High basketball at Wye High for 3 years. JV level and varsity level.
Hmm.
And those girls protected her no matter what.
But it's a real sort of intimate camaraderie, I guess. That.
Yes.
And for you, Jeff, did you learn that connection before you got involved with this? Or were you one of those people who, I mean, and there are lots of us, you know, we go about our daily lives, never seen anything, right?
I grew up with friends who someone had Downs.
Oh, okay.
And so it was always just kids to me. But I certainly knew, other folks that just didn't, you know, had the exposure. And sometimes in the school system, you know, the kids with the disabilities, you know, they sit at a different table and they do their own thing. And there's not a lot of interaction. And nothing, I'll just bring up my son again. And some of his friends, once they got to Salisbury Middle School after doing this, every single day, they would sit at the table with the other kids that would like be part of the Challenger program. And they did it all through high school. And I think it's just in. You know, I know I keep saying this, but they're just kids and they're just friends. And I think that's how they look at it.
And I get both of you, there's a certain emotional – I mean, you're big guys. Let's just say for the radio audience, you're big guys there. But there seems to be sort of a certain emotional component to this and all. Darren?
It is. You just watch how regular kids grow up and – these kids are struggling with their life, and especially the parents that have to keep taking them back and forth to doctor appointments, doctor visits, hospital stays, weeks at a time, and sometimes months at a time. It puts a strain on your whole family. It really does. And that's why the Challenger program is a good asset to other parents is due to because they can get that relief from somebody else. That's probably been there and struggled through the same component with the challengers and all the way through life, schoolwork, how school systems are set up, their behaviors in the schools, your 504s and your ADHD kids and all that, autisms.
And what about you, Jeff? There seems to be a certain emotional component to all this for you too.
I think you just become attached.
Yeah.
And you just you just love the kids, and sometimes maybe they hold a special place with them. And you know, when we did the games at West Salisbury, you know, the kids who, you know, I remember one kid who he was in a wheelchair and he couldn't walk, but I remember he wanted to be the catcher, and he insisted on getting out of his wheelchair and sitting behind home plate. And I believe I was, you know, umpiring the games.
Right.
And it's just a bond that you spilt, you know, that you should, you know, get to enjoy, share with the kids. And
Steve, this is really sort of part of, as I mentioned a moment ago, that there are lots of programs, I guess, for those who are challenged in this fashion. I mean, I take it this is sort of just one more piece of that.
It is, and I think as a county, that's been one of the exciting things about this. it's just the ability to reach out to a segment of the population and really provide an opportunity, and really that's what this is about. As the guys mentioned, this is about kids playing baseball and having opportunities, and many times these kids are either forgotten or don't know that opportunities are out there, and I'm excited that, you know, by building this, I think we're really going to have an opportunity to reach people in the county and even beyond that, where we can invite them in and give them that opportunity to participate like everybody else. And it's been one of the, honestly, in a, you know, you mentioned the emotional connection and all, you know, I'm getting more and more exposed as we go down this road. But one of the joys of this for me on a personal level is connecting with guys like Jeff and Darren and several other families that we've gotten to know and talk to as we've gone through this process. And it's just been kind of neat to, you know, intersect lives with them where ordinarily maybe you wouldn't. You just travel in different circles. And so, you know, us going down this road has really gotten already, we haven't even built anything yet, we've been able to connect with people in the community that maybe we wouldn't have connected with. And that's been fun. And I'm hoping as this continues down the track, there's a lot of other families out there that we want to connect with, and we really want to open our arms and make this a possibility for their kids to participate. So,
right, I ran across one, I can't remember who it was by, said talking about that not having this, they were sort of missing an opportunity to serve this particular segment of the population. Why do you think? I mean, obviously, you're sort of serving this population with all kinds of other programs. Why do you think we haven't done this before? Just didn't come to notice?
I don't know. Honestly, I can't speak to all that, but. You know, I can only speak from the county level. We right. have a camp that we run for special needs at Camp Pinehurst in the summertime. But beyond that, you know, we haven't done a lot. And I think there's more that can be done. And as to why it hasn't been done, I don't know the answer to that. But I think, you know, it's better late than never. One story I'll share with you. Darren's wife, Tina, obviously has been very involved with Challengers over the years. And I remember calling Tina, and I've told this story before, but I called Tina 8 or 9 months ago when we started down this path, and we had a really great conversation, and she was pretty excited about what I was trying to tell her, the direction we wanted to go. And I remember Tina kind of ending the conversation. I could hear on the end of the phone just a little bit of emotion with her, and she kind of told me at the end, she said, I've been waiting 20 years to get this phone call. And that was kind of neat, just to know that she's been out there, and Darren and people like Jeff been plugging away for a long time, and it's better late than never with this kind of thing. And I'm thrilled that we can play a part in this, and we're just really excited about it.
So when do you think you might have this this project accomplished, that field in place and the kids on the field?
So our goal is next April. We want to open up next spring. We've asked for some funding in the FY20 county budget, which will be adopted in the next month. So if the funding all falls into place as we hope, we would begin constructing it in the fall, and we'd want to open it up next spring. So because of the size of it, it's not a real big field. We can get that done in a relatively short period of time. So our goal is next spring.
By the way, how much smaller is a field? Do you have any idea what the, yes, as opposed to a regular one?
Yeah, so a typical Little League field would usually be in around a 200-foot fence, and this would be about 115. So it will be a shrunk field, and these guys can speak more to it, but Challenger in a lot of cases is an infield game, and we can raise the fence to make it play a little longer if we needed to, but we are restricted in some ways with the physical space that we have, that we can't go much bigger than 115. But we went out to, there's a Miracle League field out in Montgomery County, which is a similar type field for the same type of activity. We went there, and actually they measured the same thing, about 115 down the line. So that's about what we envision.
Jeff or Darren, so what kind of difference? I mean, obviously we're talking about size in terms of the size of the field. I assume that's fairly standard. Anything else that differs from the regular fields? Or?
Well, I think one thing that the county will be able to offer, when we've over at West Salisbury, it's one of the things you have to move around the field itself. It's a dirt infield.
Right.
And also there's a chain link fence around it. And sometimes, I know Darren and I, we've always tried to figure out, well, sometimes wheelchairs and other items don't fit through the opening. And so I believe that has restricted some kids' participation in the past. And even though when you work on a baseball field, you still don't get it smooth. And so by having the surface that Steve is talking about, might open a door for a few more. I think the other thing also is getting the county involved. The folks who are just not in Salisbury, but maybe other places, they see that does and maybe, okay, well, that's something I really want to be a part of. And I think that's part of Steve and Darren's, you know, the big picture is really just to bring it in from not just Wicomico and maybe Worcester and Somerset and Sussex, but, you know, other areas. And who knows where this thing can go. And, you know, there's that Darren had mentioned earlier, they are going to Virginia Beach for a regional tournament. And I know years ago, Darren and I talked about trying to host one here in Salisbury. And, well, having a field at the complex, now you got hotels and restaurants and all that stuff that families can travel in, and so it just opens that door.
Yeah, by the way, are there places on Delmarva that have this sort of thing? Do you know?
The only one I'm aware of in Wicomico, Worcester, Somerset is what Darren's doing at West Salisbury. Yeah.
But beyond that, like the other county,
I think Easton's got one. Yeah. Easton's got three or four teams up there. They've got a youth team now, maybe two, I think it is, and two senior teams. And she's been doing it for a long time up there. We've played them a couple times before. The last time I knew that Preston had one, but I don't know if Preston has one anymore or not. Somerset, we used to play Somerset about 4 years ago, mm-hmm. and they've the coach stopped doing that, and we ended up getting some of her ball players to play at West for a couple years.
Well, we've been speaking with Steve Miller. He's the director of Wicomico County Recreation Parks and Tourism. Also, Darren Kovacs. He is a leader of the Childhood Program at the West Salisbury Little League, and also Jeff Johnson, representative for the District 8 Little League. And we appreciate you stopping by. Good luck to you guys. And if you get it all together, we'll come down and at least cover a little bit, and maybe talk to some of the kids. That'd be really great.
That's fantastic.
Chris, thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.